This is The Doctor Is In, your bi-weekly podcast that discusses all things technical and not so technical. The Doctor Is In podcast is produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, and sponsored by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST editor Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the doctor himself, Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and Joel Hallis, W1ZR, is away this week, so you're just stuck with me this time around. And I thought it would be a good idea to talk about a topic that is rather popular among HF operators these days, and that is FT8. Chances are you've heard of FT8, maybe you haven't, but FT8 is a digital communications mode, principally used on the HF bands, but you may see it elsewhere. Pops up on 6 meters quite a bit at around 50.313. Let's talk about what it is, how you may or may not use it. If it appeals to you, that's up to you. But FT8, right at the beginning, stands for Frankie Taylor 8 FSK Modulation. Clear as mud, right? Well, Frankie is Steve Frankie, K9AN, and Taylor is Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT. Together, they collaborated and created this mode a couple of years ago. It's a narrow bandwidth digital mode that sends only about 13 characters in every transmission, and the transmission lasts about 13 seconds, and then there's this 2-second window of silence. So really, the cycle is about 15 seconds altogether per transmission. And the signals themselves sound a bit like warbling musical notes. Try listening around 14.074. You'll hear them there. You might also try 40 meters on 7.074 megahertz. You'll hear them there also. Now, one of the big questions about FT8 is, why is it so popular? And believe me, it is popular. I haven't, in all my years of being an amateur radio operator and working here at ARRL, have never seen anything quite like it. And I was here for the beginning of the PSK31 era back in 1999, and this is wildly beyond that. There are times when you'll think that the band is closed, that the band is dead, and you tune around, you're not hearing any sideband signals, hearing a handful of CW signals maybe. You tune across the FT8 frequencies and suddenly there it is. Almost any time of the day or night, it seems. If the band's open to somewhere, you will hear FT8 signals. That's virtually a guarantee. And the mystery for a lot of people is, what makes it so popular? Why are so many amateurs doing FT8 these days? Well, the reasons aren't necessarily simple, and there are a number of variables involved, if you really want to call it that. I mean, with FT8, you're really only exchanging the bare minimum of what constitutes a contact. You're exchanging call signs, a signal report in dB, and your grid square, let's say, where your station is located. The latest versions of FT8 support contesting in various ways, support de-expedition use, and you're seeing an increasing amount of that. But beyond that, there is something about the mode that seems to have a broad appeal to an awful lot of people. Some of these reasons are technical. Some of them are almost cultural, you might say, at least in an amateur radio sense. FT8 performs extremely well under very poor conditions. It has excellent weak signal performance that's actually even better than CW in most cases. What this means for many hams who have limited space antennas, maybe their antenna is in their attic, maybe they're limited to very low power levels for various reasons, With FT8, they can still make contacts at great distances. And that's a big deal to them, to hams who otherwise could not get on the air at all. And with FT8, not only do you exchange the necessary call signs and the locations of the stations, but you also get a sense of how you are being received at these stations, how strong your signal is at the other end of the path. That's a fascinating bit of information to exchange. I mean, at home, I have a very modest station. I just have a 100-foot dipole that's up about, probably 35 feet at the most. And it's fed with some ladder line and an antenna tuner, and that's it. And I run at most 100 watts of power, although not on FT8. On FT8, I'm typically running about 30 to 50 watts. And yet, I'm able to make contacts all over the world. And it's remarkable how stations can pick me up at, let's say, minus 25, minus 27 dB. That's way below the noise floor. And for a ham who is, again, living in a very restricted situation, that's a godsend, believe me. If you like to play around with antennas, if you like to explore, FT8 is great for that. I've set up, just for the heck of it, some portable antennas in my yard. In one case, just a ham stick, a little vertical antenna with some radials hanging off of it. And I ran FT8 just to see who could hear me. And again, how well they could hear me. Sometimes if I change the direction of an antenna, I might like to see what the effect of that is. And again, FT8 can tell me that. Also, it's important to point out that FT8 contacts are good for all sorts of awards. So people who are out there chasing their ARRL DX Century Club Award, DXCC, all the FT8 contacts count for that. Same thing for Worked All States, various other awards, Worked All Continents, you name it. FT8 counts for all of those. And many of the software applications, logging programs, make it very easy to upload those contacts to Logbook of the World, EQSL, Club Log, and so on. So FT8 has a really strong appeal among hams who are chasing paper, as the saying goes. FT8 also has an appeal as opposed to CW, because frankly, once you have your station set up, if you can operate a keyboard, you're on the air with FT8. Whereas with CW, you have to learn a skill. You have to learn to send and receive CW. And that's not something, for whatever reason, that many people can necessarily do. But virtually everyone is capable of pressing keys on a keyboard and making FT8 contacts that way. I think there's an appeal in FT8 for people who just want to, let's say breeze into their station and sit down in front of the computer, fire up their radio, and just make a few FT8 contacts, see how well they're getting out, see how well the bands are performing, and then they stop and they go back to whatever else they're doing. In other words, these are people who are not really interested in having a conversation, and that goes to the cultural and, if you want to call it that, the philosophical side of FT8's popularity, and that is that so-called rag-chew or conversation activities on amateur radio have been in decline. And this started really a couple of decades ago, well before the advent of FT8. I think thanks to the internet and to smartphones, people are having long, drawn-out conversations on those phones, or they're doing it on the internet, not so much on ham radio these days. And I think that is also a large driving force behind the popularity of FT8. Even on CW, frankly, you're seeing more and more exchanges that are pretty basic, just an exchange of signal reports and maybe the weather and what kind of antenna you're using, something like that. And then it's pretty much over. You don't see a lot of long, drawn-out conversations on CW, a mode that used to be famous for those. So in other words, the world is changing. Amateur radio culture is changing, and FT8 came at just the right time for that. I guess you could call that the killer app, as they say in the trade. Now, the next question, of course, is if you're interested in FT8, well, what do you need to get on the air with it? And we're going to pick that up right after we hear from DX Engineering.
Ever talk to a salesperson who didn't know the difference between a rotator and a rotary phone? Or a Yagi and a yo-yo? Or a Balin and a ballerina? You'll never have that problem with DX Engineering. When you call us, you'll talk directly with knowledgeable amateur radio experts, people who speak your language. When you contact DX Engineering, you're dealing with operators who are as passionate about the hobby as you are. This means better service, expert technical advice, and a commitment to your complete satisfaction, even long after your purchase has been made. Whether you're newly licensed or a longtime operator, you'll always find a friendly ham who understands exactly what you need on the other end of the line. Plus, you'll find a huge selection of amateur radio equipment, get the fastest shipping in the ham universe, and shipping is free on most orders over $99. Let's talk about your station. Visit us at dxengineering.com. That's dxengineering.com.
And we're back. And as promised, well, let's talk about what you need to get on the air with FT8, assuming that you're still with me and still interested in FT8. Obviously, you need a single sideband transceiver. FT8 operates strictly in the upper sideband or USB mode. You need, in many cases, an interface, something to connect the transceiver to your computer that allows your computer to key the transmitter between transmit and receive, and also allows your computer to send the transmit audio to the radio and also get the receive audio from the radio so that the software can process it. Now, many modern radios are already offering USB connections that plug directly into your computer, so you don't really need an interface at all. You could almost say that the interface is actually inside that radio, and I think you're going to see more and more of those in the years to come. But there are still an awful lot of transceivers out there that still need an interface to interact and connect with a computer. Those interfaces are all over the place. Some are fairly elaborate and kind of pricey. They can be up around $300-$400, but you really don't need that for FT8. In fact, some of the popular interfaces that sell for just $100, or some of the even the homebrew or homemade interfaces, do just as well for FT8. You don't really need anything special. Now, in terms of the computer and the software, luckily, FT8 is part of the WSJTX software suite that Joe Taylor developed. And that software is free. It runs on Windows, Mac OS X, and also Linux. So whatever computer you have, you're pretty much good to go. The software is available from Joe Taylor's website. And I'm going to read out the URL here, so be prepared to write it down or pause the podcast so you can skip back and write it down. It's kind of a long URL, so here we go. https://physics.princeton.edu, stands for Princeton University, /pulsar, P-U-L-S-A-R, that was Joe Taylor's primary research, /K1JT/WSJTX.html. I hope you got all of that, but that's the site where you need to go to. You can download the latest software from there, and you can also download the manual from there. The only strong requirement for your computer, I would say, is that your computer has to be capable of keeping accurate time. And all computers can do this, but to varying degrees, because time is important to WSJTX and, in fact, some of the other modes that Joe Taylor has come up with. You must be accurate within about 1 second. Now, Windows, which is what most hams use, is capable of doing this. In fact, Windows 10, if your station's connected to the internet, will update itself and will update its time automatically, but it only does this about once a day. So you may find that you may need to go into the settings mode and what used to be called control panel in the earlier versions of Windows, and get in there and force it to reset the time with the internet time servers. That way you know you're using the most accurate time possible. And when you're receiving the FTH signals, you'll notice there's a column labeled DT. That's Delta Tango DT. Look at the figures in that column, because that is a measure of how well your computer clock is synchronized to the clocks at the stations that you're receiving. If you're seeing differences of, say, a second or more consistently, then there's a problem, and it's most likely on your end. You should be seeing something on the order of maybe a half a second or maybe less, because if your computer clock is more than 2 seconds out of sync with the stations that are transmitting, chances are you won't copy anything at all. So do pay careful attention to that. Also, and the manual discusses this, be careful not to overmodulate your radio. Don't overdrive it. Otherwise, you'll create a horrible FTH signal, and you will not only make your fellow amateurs angry, but chances are you won't be copied that way either. Joe's manual is very good for learning how to use the software. I'm not pushing my book. I get no royalties from this, but I do have a book out there on the market. It's called Get on the Air with HF Digital. It's available from your favorite dealer, and it's available online from the ARRL store. And that book includes an entire chapter devoted not only to FT8, but also to JT65, which was more or less its predecessor, but is much less popular now. But there are many similarities, really, between the two. And I would recommend that. It's a straightforward, step-by-step setup for the software and for your radio. And one thing I neglected to mention, I said that FT8 was not a rag-chewing mode, and that's true. However, there is a version, if you will, of FT8 now that's available, not from Joe Taylor and Stephen Frankie, but from another amateur who created it, and it's called JS8 Call, just all run together, all one word, JS8 Call. And it uses FT8, but it will send and receive just free text. The conversations are very slow, as you can imagine. I mean, you're looking at a transmit window that is 15 seconds long, and so you're not going to get a lot done in 15 seconds, especially with only 13 characters. But the software kind of knits all the characters together. In other words, if you're sending a sentence such as, my antenna is a wire dipole, the first transmission might send something like, my antenna is, and the second transmission might send a wire dipole. And the software will knit those together for you so that it looks coherent. He really designed this more for nets and public service type work, but it does work well for just good old conversational rag chews, as long as you have the patience to put up with the very slow transmit-receive turnaround times. I don't have the website at hand for that. Just Google JS8 Call, and that'll take you right to his page. And right now, at least when I was recording this podcast, I believe it was for Windows only, but I'm not entirely sure of that. I know he was working on a Mac and a Linux version of it. So once again, check his webpage and see what you think. And give it a try. Why not? It's free software. Now, a Doctor Is In podcast would hardly be complete if we didn't take at least one question. And this one comes from John, KJ7CB, and he's asking, some antenna makers advertise vertical antennas with no radials needed. How good are they? Well, it's a matter of judgment. I mean, a traditional vertical monopole, which is its true name, is a quarter wavelength long and about half the length of a half-wave dipole. And usually the radials are either elevated or they're on the ground, maybe buried in the ground. And the radials really make the other half of the dipole antenna, if you will. Now, verticals without radials are usually made as an electrical half-wave. And in common with a center-fed half-wave dipole, they don't need radials. The lower half of the dipole is, well, probably you could consider it a radial that's more or less been straightened out. But what you normally find, the usual, you know, commercial no-radial vertical antenna, they have the complication that they're fed from the lower end, not from the center. In other words, they're not a vertical dipole as such. And that really adds the requirement for some kind of matching network that'll match the bottom of the antenna to 50 ohms on all the bands that you want to operate on. Plus, there has to be something to connect the shield of the coax to. There has to be a counterpoise of some sort, in other words. Usually, this looks a lot like radials, but they're shorter, usually about 4 feet long. And when you mount this thing up on a mast, you have to be careful to get the bottom, I would say, at least 7 feet up in the air so that those radials don't poke someone in the eye when they're walking under your antenna. Now, there are indeed some verticals that don't have radials of any kind, that don't have counterpoises either, for that matter. And many of these are really essentially dummy loads. They're usually a resistive load that's got a radiating element connected to it. Will they work? Yeah, they'll work. I mean, anything will radiate. Light bulbs will radiate, technically speaking, but they don't do the job well. My experience has been, and I'm sure Joel Hallis would agree, that verticals with radials, whether, once again, they're elevated, whether they're on top of the soil or buried in the soil, will almost always outperform any other type of vertical design, except, once again, a vertical dipole. That's a different kettle of fish. But if you're talking about the type of vertical that just has the four-foot-long counterpoise elements, or the one we just mentioned that is just nothing more than a resistive load with a whip on it, you know, or some sort of radiating element, the vertical, the traditional vertical with the radials, will almost always outperform that. And usually the more radials to the better, up to a point. We had an article some time ago in QST that talked about the fact that usually you can get away with about, 10 radials, 30 maybe, and get excellent performance from a vertical. Don't think that you have to cut the ground and lay 30 or more radials in the soil. You really don't have to do that. In my own experience, I've taken radial wires and put them right on top of the grass, and I use these lawn staples to hold them into the lawn, and give it a few months, especially in the spring, and Mother Nature will take care of hiding those radials for you. And again, you don't need large numbers of radials. If all you can do is put up a vertical antenna that has, I don't know, let's say 4, maybe 6 radials on top of the ground, so be it. I think you'll be surprised, and I think you'll find that even that antenna will have superior performance to, to especially the dummy loads with radiating elements. So, that's the end of the Doctor Is In podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Good luck. We'll see you down the road.
If you have a question for the doctor, email us at doctor@arrl.org. The Doctor Is In podcast is sponsored by DX Engineering at www.dxengineering.com. Background music provided by Purple Planet at www.purple-planet.com. This podcast is copyright ARRL. All rights are reserved. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.